And we've been saying that these are some of the challenging problems. Labor and management in America share a tremendous joint responsibility. Labor and management must demonstrate that their responsibility to the whole community comes before their loyalty to any small, special economic group that they might each represent. We have said all along that we want to make progress with the community, not at the expense of the community. We have said that economic conflicts between labor and management must be settled on the basis of economic facts, not upon the basis of economic power. And we have said that labor and management must demonstrate the capacity of leadership to elevate collective bargaining above the level of a never-ending conflict between economic pressure groups. Collective bargaining has got to be an extension of the democratic processes by which labor and management mutually explore the basic economic facts in an effort to find an answer that will advance the welfare of the total community. And I say, to the extent that labor and management can carry out that kind of joint responsibility, to that extent, we will strengthen the forces of democracy and freedom in America. And the thing that we've been saying to management is, you talk about the government interfering. If you want to minimize the need of government intervention into the economic life of our nation, then you can do that by accepting on a voluntary basis the social responsibility that goes with the ownership of industry. In a free society, there is no substitute for the voluntary acceptance of social responsibility on the part of major economic groups. We have been driving that home. One of the reasons we get in trouble in America is that too often we take the negative approach when we ought to be working on a positive basis. The Taft-Hartley Act is an illustration of that point. We said a long time ago that the Taft-Hartley Act would fail because it was a negative approach to problems that required positive solutions. In the last 8 months, coal miners have been on strike, the steel workers, automobile workers, more than 1 million workers. Why? Because those workers were unable to achieve the economic security and the social justice to which they thought they were entitled by other methods. In a police state, under Hitler and Stalin, under any police state, you can achieve industrial peace without justice. But in a society of free men, industrial peace is possible only as a byproduct of economic and social justice. If people want to achieve industrial peace in America, then they've got to work on a positive basis to facilitate the achievement of the kind of economic justice that will make peace possible. They've got to pass the kind of positive social legislation that will facilitate the achievement of more of the good things of life on the part of the great mass of people. Out of that greater security, you'll get greater stability. But you can't do it by trying to pass punitive, negative legislation, because it just won't work. Let me cite another example of the negative approach. I spoke to the National Convention of the Social Workers of America in Cleveland some time back. They spent a whole day discussing the problem of juvenile delinquency. And that is a very serious problem. Our children grow up in slums without decent homes, without wholesome recreational facilities to give them opportunity of expression, and they get into trouble. And when they get into trouble, we're always prepared to appropriate money to build jails to put them in. That's the negative approach. I said to this conference of social workers, If we're really concerned with the problem of juvenile delinquency, if we really want to do something to try to minimize it and eliminate it, then we've got to drive on the positive side. What we've got to do is to build fewer and fewer houses of correction and more correct houses for our children to live in America. That's the positive approach to this kind of a problem. Our problem in America is really not juvenile delinquency. It's more serious than that. It's adult delinquency. That's our basic problem. It's the adults in America who are delinquent. They're delinquent in the discharge of their basic responsibility as democratic citizens. In Washington, you see down there daily, and I spend some considerable time there, what I call the tragic congressional mentality. It's a mentality that either lacks the courage or the vision or the will take on the basic challenge of peace. They say we can't afford peace. This is the kind of blind congressional mentality that voted billions and billions for battleships and bombers and destruction and war. And when you say, what about peace? They give you pennies for people in peace. I worked in Washington during the war on a number of the commissions there that President Roosevelt had appointed me to. And I watched the whole congressional process in operation. I saw the Army and the Navy and the Air Corps go over on Capitol Hill, here before the Appropriations Committee, ask for billions for battleships, billions for tanks, billions for bombs. And these same congressmen would walk up to a 24-inch pipeline and open that pipeline and appropriate billions for war. But when you go down there now and you talk about decent housing, you talk about people and peace, you talk about positive human values, oh, they give you a nice patriotic speech, get you out of their office, and then they walk over to the congressional medicine cabinet and get on an eyedropper. Now, isn't there something wrong with a country that can spend billions for war and destruction, hasn't got the courage to spend money to make life better? Paul Huffman, testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee some weeks ago, developed the cost of the Second World War when it's projected down the road in terms of the accumulated cost. He said the cost of the Second World War was $1,300 billion. It lasted 44 months. And it cost us $29.5 billion per month, $985 million per day, or $41 million per hour. Now let's take that expenditure for war, for the destruction of human values, for negative values, and let's lay it down beside some of the positive things we're fighting for, and let's see what the relative cost is. Take the plight of the American school. A year ago, it was a national scandal. Today, it's a national tragedy, what's happening to the American school system. We had swing ships in our factories during the war, but we abolished the swing ships in our factories when the war was over, and we instituted them in our school system. Overcrowded schools. In Detroit, I moved from one neighborhood because my girls would be going to school half-time for 4 years because the school system is not adequate to take care of the increased students. We're robbing millions of American children of a rightful educational opportunity. And our youth is our most valuable national asset. And yet, down in Washington, this blind congressional mentality says we can't afford $300 million federal aid to education. What does that mean compared to the cost of the war? $300 million represents less than the cost of operating the war for one-third of a day. Now, isn't there something wrong? Isn't there something morally wrong with a nation that is willing to spend billions and billions to equip and train our youth to die in war, isn't willing to spend a few billion dollars to educate and equip our youth to live in peace? There's something wrong. We've got to find out what it is, and we've got to do something about it. Take old age security. I testified before the Senate Finance Committee on old age security two or three weeks ago, and I developed what I call the minimum family budget for an aged couple in America. That budget was $174 a month. Now, we didn't guess at that figure. We had our research department working for 4 months, analyzing the living costs in a number of major cities and projecting this budget. We had it broken down, one house dress for the woman every year, one apron every 2.5 years, one handkerchief every year 9 weeks. The man was to get a new overcoat every 8 years. They were each to consume 1/8 of a pound of butter per week. Broken down, and I said to these senators, there were 9 of them sitting there, I said, you show me one single item in this budget of $174 that you think is too high. I couldn't find one item. Now, this budget is double the budget that's being proposed in the law that's under consideration in Washington, which is called H.R. 6000. That's the act passed by the House of Representatives, which is now being considered by the Senate. This budget is double that. It's 3.5 times the current federal Social Security budget. Now they say, well, that's all very fine, Mr. Reuther. Wonderful sentiment. We know that you're trying to get security and dignity into the lives of the old people of this country. That's a noble objective, and we feel very sympathetic about your ideas about this. But we can't afford it, they said. We can't afford to give the people, when they're too old to work in America, security and dignity in the autumn of their lives. You see, that's the thing we're afraid. So I said, well, how much do you think it costs? By 1955, the $174 budget which we projected, 1955 represents the high level cost because we're moving up to that figure. In 1955, that budget would represent 2% of the total national wealth created by the American economy. Can we afford to spend 2% of our national wealth per year to give people security and dignity in their old age? I say the answer is obvious. It would cost, in dollar figures, $6.3 billion, or equal to the cost of the war of 1 week. 1 week's cost of the war would pay for this high benefit for a full year for all the millions of old couples in America. If we put our 5 million unemployed to work, they could create enough wealth to pay for all of these things and have a lot left over. We lost last year, because of unemployment, more than $15 billion in wealth that if those workers had been working, they could have created. The National Association of Manufacturers, and I meet those gentlemen all over America, you know, they've got the mistaken notion that you can build the future by recapturing the past. Unfortunately, the future does not lie behind us. It lies ahead of us. We've got to build it. We can't capture it. Now, the National Association of Manufacturers, in their latest report, said that things were going fine, but actually, if we kept within 5 to 10% below or above the 1949 levels of production, that would be satisfactory. Now, if we had 10% below the 49, we would lose $43 billion in wealth that we could create. $43 billion of wealth lost in 1 year. See, that's the old concept of economic scarcity. They're afraid of abundance. They're afraid to mobilize the power of America in peacetime. If we could get this concept of abundance really accepted in America, and we could go about the development of our resources and the utilization of our manpower, we could conquer poverty and insecurity in America, and we could do other things. We need more TVAs. We need to develop the Missouri Valley and the Columbia and the St. Lawrence Waterway. It'll put a lot of people to work. It'll develop new resources and make more wealth available for distribution.